You've been listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben on TRN. Join us again tomorrow morning right here at 97.7 FM on the Tyranny Response Network for Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben with Integrity Group. Why is it so difficult for Christians to be good stewards of
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a PhD degree in public policy, MA degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
Welcome to Christian Worldview. This is Dr. John Coben. Having a little bit of a slow start today. We have, again, still encountering a few technical difficulties and glitches here, so I hope that you'll bear with us as we attempt this morning to bring you Christian Worldview. It's 55, it'll be 55 degrees in Greenville today. It's currently a little bit cloudy, around 36 degrees outside, but we'll warm up to 55 and have mostly sunny days today. If you can just bear with us for just a minute again, folks, on the Tyranny Response Network, we greatly appreciate it. The phone number here to reach the station is 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. You can also send your questions to us by email to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. Welcome back to the show. This is Dr. John Coben. I'm sorry, folks, but we've had some difficulties. It seems our difficulties are never-ending at the Tyranny Response Network. That's the problem you have with a volunteer organization. We appreciate your patience with us as we endeavor to do the best job we possibly can for you. A lot of staff are out of town today, and believe it or not, the Tyranny Response Unit has been instructed over the phone how to try to run the production board, which is almost an impossible feat to do at the same time as you're speaking. So at any rate, we'll hope to have a substitute producer here at any time. And in the meantime, we're on the air and we're glad that we're able to bring you Christian Worldview this morning from Greenville, South Carolina, our home base on the Tyranny Response Network. We have several things that have come up in the news this morning that I think are quite entertaining and interesting. First of all, CNN reports in Washington, an experimental naval interceptor shot down a short-range ballistic missile target during a test over the Pacific Ocean on Thursday, missile defense officials said. It is the fifth kill in six tries for the interceptor called a Standard Missile 3, said Rick Lehner, a spokesman for the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency. During the test, a target ballistic missile similar to a Scud was launched from the island of Kauai at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, the USS Lake Erie, a cruiser equipped with the Aegis radar system and stationed 100 miles offshore, tracked the ballistic missile and then fired the interceptor to shoot it down. 2 minutes later, the missiles collided. The SM-3 interceptor will be deployed on ships later this year. Leia said. So it sounds like Star Wars is here, except it's going to be working from the Earth instead of outer space. Apparently, we have now the ability to shoot down with great deal of success. I say we, the United States government has a means to shoot down with great deal of success incoming nuclear warheads and so forth, intercontinental ballistic missiles, which is really to have this kind of accuracy we haven't had before. So it is quite interesting that we see this in the National Defense Program. What do Christians think about advances in national defense? I mean, should we be elated by it? Should we be satisfied with it? I mean, after all, if we have a government, and the reason we have government primarily is to provide for our defense as a collective entity. We want to actually make sure that we have enough firepower, enough defense to prevent us from being attacked and assaulted and taken over and abused by predatory nations or any predator of any kind, whether it be a terrorist or otherwise. So here we have an opportunity to expand our military. Well, for my part, folks, I don't have too much of a problem with it as long as the government we have supports liberty. The problem is when the government becomes so powerful, and this is where the rub comes, I guess you could say, when the government becomes so powerful that citizens are overwhelmed, that there's no possible way they can overthrow their own state when it becomes tyrannical, then we have difficulty. In other words, if the United States government was actually doing just what the Constitution required it to do, there'd be no question that it'd be greatest to have the most powerful defense possible. But as soon as you lose that attitude among the state or that characteristic of the state, and it becomes tyrannical and it has also this kind of power, then we see abuses begin and we have great concerns. Remember, the Soviet Union, even though it was never as much as powerful as the United States, had a lot of power. And in spite of that the power, it abused its citizens instead of protecting its citizens from outsiders, although I suppose it did that too, kept them in and fenced them in, but also abused them to the point of murdering millions of them, expropriating property and other things. So powerful states are a problem. And it's nice to have the strongest national defense in the world, but it's also not nice to have that when you have a tyrannical system. So you have to ask yourself, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I tend to think it's a good thing just because I do believe there are a lot of terrorists out there, and I have a lot of confidence in the United States military in many respects. I'm glad that they're there doing their job and doing their best. I'm not real pleased with all of the military's policies, however. And I certainly wouldn't want to be considered a hawk in that regard. I'm not in favor of the unjust wars that are waged, but I don't blame the military for the unjust wars. I blame it on the power-hungry, demagogic presidents that we have who declare war now without Congress, such as Clinton and Bush, G.W. Bush. So at any rate, I have some concerns about our military policy. Nevertheless, I do like a strong military. You may have a different view, though. You may think, well, this is horrible. We should not have any kinds of advancements in technology, or these technology advancements are not good from a Christian worldview. After all, we're supposed to turn the other cheek. You may have all sorts of arguments against it. Be glad to hear from you. You can call the show at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Well, we have a couple of things I wanted to go over early on the program today. One of which is I've been reading from Bruce Short's book, The Harsh Truth About Public Schools. We read the review of this some time ago, and it was so good I decided to order the book. Been reading it and have not been disappointed. Haven't had much time to sit down and read the 370-page book or whatever it is, something like that. But I have been, whenever I had a chance, thumbing through the pages and scouring for great content and detail that can be useful from the Christian Worldview show. And indeed, on page 51, there is a section called, or a subsection called, Sow the Wind, Reap the Whirlwind. He says, are you still convinced that sending your children to government schools is harmless? Is it plausible to think that giving Wiccans, that's W-I-C-A-N, C-C-A-N from Wicca, the witchcraft, semi-witchcraft cult, that giving Wiccans, secular humanists, Gaia worshippers, and sundry purveyors of Eastern religions or Islam the opportunity to proselytize your children through classroom instruction, textbooks, assemblies, field trips, peer pressure, extracurricular activities, and adult example for at least 35 hours a week makes no difference to their faith? Evidence that Christians have failed to transmit their faith and values to their children is everywhere. Within 2 years of graduation from high school, between 70% and 88% of teenagers from evangelical families stop attending church. Over the last 40 years, teen suicide has increased by 200%. And since 1970, adult arrests for drug law violations are up over 400%. By 1999, 33% of all children were born out of wedlock. This represents an increase in the rate of illegitimacy of over 700% since 1940, with the greatest increase coming after 1960. Plainly, these results proceed from the values held by individuals. Can anyone really believe that the actions behind these statistics reflect these the values of a sincerely held Christian worldview? Do you really believe that attending government schools has no influence on the sort of worldview your child develops? Fortunately, for the doubters, a study conducted by the Nehemiah Institute makes clear how attending government schools shapes the minds of Christian children. In its study, the Nehemiah Institute evaluated the worldviews of thousands of children from Christian families attending government schools and private Christian schools in nearly all 50 states. The study was conducted using a test designed to assess how biblically or non-biblically students think on culture-shaping issues. Responses to the questions allowed the researchers to categorize the students' worldviews into four categories: 1, biblical theism; 2, moderate Christian; 3, secular humanism; or 4, socialism. The study found significant differences between the worldviews of children who attended government schools and the worldviews of children who attended private Christian schools. For example, only 35.3% of the Christian children in government schools strongly agreed that the foundation of all government is self-government under God, while 7.4% of all of the children attending private Christian schools strongly agreed. Even more telling was the response to the following statement: because human nature is constantly changing, listen to this statement, folks. Because human nature is constantly changing, values and ethics will also change. Therefore, each generation should be free to adopt the moral standards appropriate to their preferences. I'm going to read that again. And this is the question they're asking them to evaluate. Because human nature is constantly changing, values and ethics will also change. Therefore, each generation should be free to adopt moral standards appropriate to their preferences. Only 14.7% of Christian children attending government schools strongly disagreed with this statement, while 74.3% of children attending private Christian schools strongly disagreed. Overall, the study showed that children from non-Christian homes who also attended private Christian schools had worldviews that varied from moderate Christian to biblical theism. On the other hand, the students from Christian homes who attended government schools had worldviews that fell predominantly within the categories of secular humanism or socialism. Isn't that incredible? I mean, anyone who believes that the public school, as Bruce Stuart calls it, the pagan seminary, has no effect on their children as Christians is sadly deceived. The public school is winning its battle to rule the hearts and minds of young people and actually transform the culture away from a Christian-based civilization into one that is based on a secular humanist-based system and based understanding of the world. In fact, there was another quote in here which I thought was just tremendous from a guy among the national a man named Charles Potter, signer of the first humanist manifesto. And writing in a little book in 1930, he says, regarding this humanist manifesto, he says, "Education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism, and every public school is a school of humanism." Can't be much clearer than that. And that's indeed what has been confirmed from reading Short and the other news items that come down the pike about public schooling. Education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism, and every public school is a school of humanism. What can the theistic Sunday school meeting for an hour once a week and teaching only a fraction of the children do to stem the tide of a 5-day program of humanistic teachings? Oh, my. So true. And Paul Blanchard also adds in a great quotation here about what's really going on. "Our schools may not teach Johnny to read properly, but the fact that Johnny is in school until he is 16 tends to lean toward this elimination of religious superstition." It also gets rid of, actually, nowadays they are promoting a lot of religious superstition and shows that Islam is alive and well, environmental worship, like Mother Gaia worship, and all sorts of pagan ideas are alive and well, including witchcraft and Wicca and deep ecology, these kinds of theses. While Christianity is flushed down the drain, and by the time a person gets out of school, out of public school, it's very difficult for them to continue on in the faith. Well, at any rate, we appreciate Bruce Short's book. If you have any comments about the public school, we'd like to hear from you and talk to you about them. We want to continue on with a couple other interesting articles. I'm going to give you the phone number once again. It's 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. You can send your questions and comments by email to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. We also have a couple of things coming down from the Tyranny Response Unit Research Department. There is apparently a bill coming down, H-3187 in South Carolina. It's about education and public works, which I thought was quite interesting. This is a bill that will actually change the way that public school and schooling districts are charter are set up in the state, especially with charter schools. It says that the purpose of this bill is to provide that the Board of Trustees of the district may promulgate regulations, of course. The mission of the South Carolina Virtual Charter School District would be to provide students with technology-based educational opportunities to gain the knowledge and skills necessary to succeed. The program established pursuant to this charter requires a high level of parental participation and significant commitment from the students to allow continued participation in the program. The boundaries of the South Carolina Virtual School District are the boundaries of the state. There must be appointed by the governor. Three must be appointed by the governor, two by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and two by the President pro tempore of the Senate. The board shall report annually to the General Assembly. The report must include a school district status and financing, success of the students, overall status of the district, approved course curriculum, and other information pertinent to the long-term direction of the virtual charter program, charter school program. It must also provide the students with necessary software and hardware along with internet connections to ensure that students of all economic environments have an equal opportunity to participate in the virtual charter school. So instead of having just one or two charter schools here and there that are really high quality, now we're going to go technology-based onto the internet, and we are going to try to get folks to participate in this new kind of school program over the internet and move along. We're going to take a quick break here, folks. We'll be back in just a minute.
Critical analysis.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben. As many of you know that the Tyranny Response Network is listener supported, and here's Gene Papke to tell you how you can support the Tyranny Response Network.
That's right, John. Folks, if you support TRN and you want to help financially, here's how. We at TRN are a 501c3 listener supported broadcast, but we don't take a notions, potions, and lotions approach to fundraising. If you own, operate, or work for a company with bad paper, that is, non-performing assets, we can turn that garbage into gold. Simply go to our website, NP Pros, that's N as in non, P as in profit, P-R-O-S as in professionals, your non-profit professionals, that's nppros.com. And remember, we raise funds, but without fundraisers.
Log on today to www.npros.com and find out how you can be a vital part in supporting the Tyranny Response Network.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955, weekday mornings from 7:30 to 9. You may also email your questions and comments 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
And we're welcome back to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Still trying to run the production facilities on my own here and hopefully doing an adequate job to get things out on the air this morning on the Tyranny Response Network. Glad you've joined us, and we're happy to be able to produce the show this morning and provide for you quality content for you who are thinking people, whether you be those who are Christians who are wanting to think deeper or those who just simply love liberty. Glad that you're able to join in. Well, why was I reading about these charter schools a minute ago? Well, the reason is, as we see, the public school is up to something here. We don't trust the public school here at the Tyranny Response Network. We see them as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, force for evil in the United States. The anti-forces, anti-liberty forces, pro-socialist forces, anti-Christian forces are all alive and well at the public school. And Bruce Short's book shores that up and shows it very well. What's going on in these institutions. Well, in another article from the research staff, we have virtual school recruiting students from across the state, it says. This virtual charter school is expanding with an eye, and this is from the Journal World newspaper, it says from Sarah Fox, and this is actually from February 7th, but interesting that we can look back and a couple weeks here and see where things have been progressing. With an eye towards educating homeschool students wherever they're found, Lawrence Virtual School officials have begun a statewide recruiting drive. Now, this is in Kansas. Gary Lewis, the online school's principal, is traveling across Kansas to conduct a four-month series of 40 open houses in Colby, Coffeyville, Wichita, and other Kansas cities. The aim is to explain what virtual schooling is and clear up any myths. I want to make it very clear, Lewis said. You're not just going to put your child at a computer and say, here's school. So they want to gain pupils statewide, and they've got all sorts of programs to do this. Now, why is this a concern? Well, South Carolina is also starting one of these virtual charter schools, and it's another way that the public school is trying to get at homeschooled kids. There is no greater threat to the socialist agenda, to the humanist agenda, to the anti-Christian agenda, than the homeschoolers. And the reason I say that is not to put down Christian schools, because there are many good Christian schools, but let's face it, Christian schools often use the same textbooks or very similar textbooks with very similar ideas as the public schools do. They follow a curriculum that's very similar to what the public school is required to teach kids, and frankly, it's a lot easier for them to infiltrate and manipulate the Christian and private schools than it is homeschooling. Homeschooling is simply wide open. I mean, the parent is free to teach whatever he wants to the child. And remarkably, we have a great deal of success in doing so because the homeschooled children, on average, do far better on standardized tests than do the other students. In fact, I believe it's close to 100 points better on average on an SAT exam and maybe 2 or 3 points better on the ACT exam. So they're better prepared. We have all seen the shining stars of success come through homeschooling, and the great concern of the secular humanist is these people are not only not getting the 35 hours a week of indoctrination, they're getting 35 hours a week of indoctrination on the other side from biblical theism, or at least if the people are homeschooling are not Christians, they're getting indoctrinated with the ideas of liberty and of free markets from Thomas Jefferson and so forth, John Locke, Adam Smith, and all the way down through Mises and Milton Friedman and people like that. This is a great concern for those in the secular humanist side because their plan, their Fabian socialist gradualist plan, is to increase slowly over time until they completely take over the mind of the children of society, of American society, and therefore transform it into a completely secularist humanist state. Homeschooling is a step backwards for them. For us, it's the greatest thing we've got going to promote liberty, to promote our traditional Christian values here in America. And so we're very, very happy to have homeschooling, while others are very concerned that they have it at all. So the virtual charter school thing is another way that they're trying to infiltrate homeschool families. They're going to try to tempt them to come on online, take the state's courses there, get indoctrinated with the philosophy of humanism and Darwinism and Mother Gaia and Wicca and whatever else is going on, deep ecology. And after they get them indoctrinated, hope to persuade them of the other side, the other way, because they just are not having the influence on these kids that they would like to have. So sad. We feel sorry for you leftists out there, but we really don't. We're hoping for the destruction of the public school, not hoping for its advancement. We also have, interestingly enough, a debate related to Put Parents in Charge, the Put Parents in Charge bill coming up in South Carolina, which will have ramifications all over the country, I believe. It's a bill that is designed to give tax credits to children, and tax credits to parents of children who attend homeschools or who attend private or Christian schools, and these credits would be designed to obviously offset the tuition costs and so forth. Only available to those who are making $75,000 a year or less. Talked about this on the show the other day, yesterday and the day before and a couple days ago, because I think it's a terrible policy. Not because you can get the tax credit, but because what you have to do to give up to get the tax credit is liberty. It's an open door, as far as I'm concerned, for socialism, the advancement of socialism, and the advancement of regulation into the hearts and minds, into the homes and families of Christian families. Folks, here at the Tyranny Response Network, people know that the Tyranny Response Unit is one of those single-focus kind of guys that can sort of not chew gum and walk at the same time. And when I've got to do a production studio and keep my eye on five things at once, if it sounds like I'm stammering or not quite completely cogent in some of my speech here, it's because I'm trying to do too many things at once. And if I'm doing more than one thing at a time, it's too many. Little joke there, I actually can do more than one thing at a time, but not very well. At least my wife will tell you that, and probably some others who know me. But I can do one thing at a time very well, and we're hoping to do that here on the Tyranny Response Network. We're gonna come up in a break right here pretty soon, but I want to mention one other thing, and that is be aware if you're in Greenville, South Carolina, on Monday morning, that's next week, 3 days from now, on February 28th at 10 o'clock at the Sims Library on Pelham Road, there will be a debate sponsored by the Americans for Constitutional Government with six panelists, Ben Graydon and I and Juliet Kosak from the side that's opposed to this PPIC bill, the Put Parents in Charge Act, as well as squaring off with three conservatives or neoconservatives from the other side who actually support the tax credit and they want the carrot in spite of the stick. And we're going to be discussing these things in some detail at 10 o'clock till noon, Sims Library on Pelham Road in Greenville, South Carolina. If you're interested in attending, please do. There is no admission charge, and it's open to the public. Don't expect an enormous crowd. They're probably no more than 100 people. But at any rate, we do encourage you to come and make your voice heard, ask them good questions, and bring your thoughts regarding this great issue or this important issue with you. You can find my article on the subject, which will be published in next week's Times Examiner, which we'd encourage you to get. Pick up a copy at 44 Pine Knoll Drive, by the way, in Greenville, South Carolina. The Times Examiner, great paper with great columnists. My column will appear there about putting parents in charge, critical of the program, next week. And I'll be also passing that out to some people there on Monday morning. But you can go to my webpage, or the webpage, which is policyofliberty.net. And simply by going to that page, you'll be able to log in to a section that's called Articles and Books, Articles and Papers. And if you click on the Articles and Papers, you can scroll down and find my latest Times Examiner article, read what I have to think about PPIC and why I think it should not be passed whatsoever in its current form. The following week, I'll be working on an article with a more positive light on how instead we should form this policy. You know, we want to keep the tax credits and give the maximum amount of protection to homeschoolers. How do we do that? Well, the way we do that is through a different kind of policy whatsoever, rather than this very liberal policy that's been proposed. Anyway, we're a little bit late for our break here. We'll be back in just a few minutes on Christian Worldview Day with Dr. John Coben on the Tyranny Response Network.
Try some ear candy for thinking
people. Hi,
this is Dr.
John Coben.
Listen to Liberty Minute.
The Tyranny Response Network is listener-supported. This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a PhD degree in public policy, MA degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
Welcome back to Christian Worldview. This is Dr. John Coben at Tyranny Response Network. I am your Tyranny Response Unit. We're looking forward to a grand day here on the Tyranny Response Network, even though we're having our own broadcast and technical difficulties, as has unfortunately plagued us this particular week. I wanted to refer us to a very interesting article. Virtually everything that's written in the Freeman is an interesting article, and encourage you to have a look at the webpage for the Foundation for Economic Education. That's FEE.org. And learn how to subscribe to the Freeman. It comes out monthly or maybe bi-monthly now. I think they may have changed the format to bi-monthly. And this magazine can be purchased, I think, for a donation of $10 per year for students. And I believe it's $39 otherwise. But if you happen to have a homeschooled student or a Christian school student or any other student in your home, just go ahead and sign up under his name. The magazine still comes to your address. I imagine you'll still get to read it for the $10. So by all means, get this in your hands one way or another. Everything I read in here, virtually everything I read, is just tremendous. Very insightful, top quality scholars, Richard Ebeling, Walter Williams, and many other well-known scholars write in here about all sorts of interesting topics. This particular issue, the January-February issue, had a lot to say about socialized medicine. It has to do about building with sports stadiums. Some simple tests for understanding free market economics, how government can just be very destructive in society, problems with democracy and the idea of a consensus society. And they even have an article on Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand is not a person who I think had a Christian worldview whatsoever. Her objectivist principles, however, and to some extent can be applied to the Christian worldview. I don't think they're necessarily antithetical. But by all means, we would encourage people to be familiar with the free market philosophy, at least that aspect of Ayn Rand. Well, in one particular article in here by Richard Ebeling, who used to be a professor at Hillsdale College and now is the president of Foundation for Economic Education, there's an article called Government Fiscal Responsibility and Free Banking. He starts out this article by saying, "There has been no greater threat to life, liberty, and property throughout the ages than government. Even the most violent and brutal private individuals have been able to inflict only a mere fraction of the harm and destruction that have been caused by the use of power by political authorities. Boy, that statement is worth reading again, because it's just so absolutely true. There has been no greater threat to life, liberty, and property throughout the ages than government. Even the most violent and brutal private individuals have been able to inflict only a mere fraction of the harm and destruction that have been caused by the use of power by political authorities. The pursuit of legal plunder, to use Frederick Bastiat's well-known phrase, has been behind all the major economic and political disasters that have befallen man throughout history. We often forget that the fundamental truth that governments have nothing to spend or redistribute that they do not first take from society's producers. The fiscal history of mankind is nothing but a long, uninterrupted account of the methods governments have devised for seizing the income and wealth of their citizens and subjects. And parallel to that same history must be an account of all the attempts by the victims of government's legal plunder to devise countermethods to prevent or at least limit the looting of their income and wealth by those in political power. Isn't that a great way to start an article? I couldn't agree with him more. It's an excellent choice of words, an excellent way to put the predicament we're in under any kind of a state. Well, here he goes on to talk about how government completely undermined the gold standard in America. Remember, some folks maybe it's too young to know this it's been whitewashed pretty much out of public schools now. But there was a time in America, folks, where we did not have paper money that was not backed by something. In fact, from 1776, and of course the colonial period, all the way up to Abraham Lincoln's time, paper money only existed in virtually large denominations that were used by and issued by private banks. The vast majority of people traded coins that were gold or silver, and that was money. Money was the gold or silver. It was minted by governments, that's true, and they guaranteed the fineness of the gold or the silver and the weight, and that was important. And the different governments would also have their coins that they would mint, and even in America you could find Spanish coins, French coins, British coins, American coins. As long as they were an ounce of gold, people were interested in them. And so we find, just a moment, we'll be right back. Again, trying to run a production studio on my own is a little bit difficult. We have some folks trying to call in this morning, and we encourage you to do that. However, it's going to be difficult for me to get you on the air sometimes, just because trying to run it on my own is a little bit more difficult. 864-201-6955 is the phone number, 864-201-6955. If you've tried to call in, please go ahead and try again. We'll be happy to take your calls here on the Tyranny Response Network, Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. At any rate, people were paid with whatever kind of coin they could get their hands on, whether it was gold or silver, and they were pleased to have it entirely and to work for it. And people would go to work and be paid in gold and silver, often at the end of the day. They didn't have to wait for a paycheck. There were no deductions out of one's checks for various taxes that were done. People weren't paid with paychecks. In fact, even after the greenback was instituted for a short period of time and then died out till the end of, and that was during the 1860s under Lincoln, all the way up through the early 1900s, really till around 1920, when people got paid, they were paid with gold and silver, or they were paid with a private bank note, or even after the start of the Federal Reserve, they were issued cash in an envelope every day. You went to a pay window, a little shack at the end, at the place of your employment, and they would issue an envelope full of cash, full of paper dollars. And interestingly enough, that's the way people got paid. Most people don't realize that nowadays. They've just completely forgotten. People can't imagine getting paid for work other than perhaps weekly or monthly or semi-monthly, and with a lot of deductions coming out of one's check. Well, in that time, you got paid, if you were paid a dollar an hour, you got a dollar an hour. At the end of the day, you worked 10 hours, they gave you $10. That was just the way that it worked. Of course, a dollar was worth a whole lot more then than it is now, if that's what they got paid. At any rate, these things all began to change as government undermined our system of currency. And what Eberling points out in this article is that the gold standard was first shelved under FDR in the mid-1930s. Of course, he traces back the predecessor movements to eliminating gold to World War I under President Woodrow Wilson. We really had a tough time in America because we had almost back-to-back idiots running the White House, namely Woodrow Wilson. When I say idiots, I'm talking about philosophical idiots. Obviously, they were very smart men, shrewd and prudent in knowing what they were doing. What they were doing was also evil. After Wilson got us into the League of Nations, and under his watch, we went through this scandalous World War I event. We went to FDR, who in the Great Depression, which was also caused by state bungling, messing with the money supply, and also through state misappropriation of funds through subsidy programs throughout the 1920s, protectionist tariffs and so forth during the 1920s. This all led to the Great Depression. After the government causes the Great Depression, we end up seeing government trying to bail us out through all its welfare state programs, and we have then the beginning through Franklin Delano Roosevelt of the greatest welfare state movement the world has ever known, and in the United States, never to go back to the old system of sound money. Well, what Eberling points out in his article is that, look, there are other means of doing of an economics in a macroeconomic sense than the current system we have now, and he makes a case out of the country of Panama. Panama has no central bank. They don't have a Federal Reserve to issue the green notes. Instead, Panama has a system where they use American dollars. It's completely dollarized. They don't have a bank that has power to sway the America or the Panamanian economy. Their bank is not able to manipulate things. Instead, the government simply has to live within its means, and the government has no way to inflate. The government has no way to lead the economy away from catastrophe, alleged catastrophe, or to cause catastrophe. In the case of Panama, it's completely free in terms of the market for money, and so he's arguing here, and I think does a good job of doing so, that the best thing you can possibly have is no central bank. And if that means dollarizing and at least using American dollars instead of and which still isn't, it's still problematic because you're just removing that one step backwards. You're having still the American government controlling money. Instead, you can have a private system of banks that are in Panama or elsewhere issuing their own currencies. And this whole idea of free banking developed really back in the 1970s, 1980s. With some professors out of the University of Georgia and elsewhere. They really expanded it, Larry White and George Selgin especially, into saying, look, if we have competitive forces in the issuance of money, we're going to have all the benefits of competition, pursuit of high reputation, and the maintenance of liberty and quality, and equality even to some extent, if we just have private bank money. We don't even need a gold standard, they argue, as long as each individual bank, be it Bank of America, Citibank, Wachovia, whatever it might be, issue their own currency and have to compete on the market so that if people believe their currency is being degraded, it goes down relative to other currencies, and they have competitive note issue, each striving to keep their reputation high and therefore doing what they can to maintain quality of their banknotes. This would take the federal government completely out of the picture. It would also knock out the great banking interests of the world, the Rothschilds, the Vanderbilts, or Warburgs, or Rockefellers, or whatever their representatives are nowadays on the Federal Reserve Board, who are actually controlling the world's money supply and utilizing it for their own purposes. We see, as a matter of fact, in many cases, the Federal Reserve has been a manipulative tool for gaining great profits for private individuals. Many people don't realize this, but the Federal Reserve controls almost all the major banking in America, and in many respects probably has an influence on banking throughout the world. But the central bank in America requires what they call a reserve requirement from every bank, and it's usually anywhere from 10 to 15%. There's some smaller banks that might have higher reserve requirements, but most banks are somewhere around 12-13% of all the money they take in has to be put on reserve or at the Federal Reserve Bank. They get no interest for this money they put on reserve, but the Federal Reserve gets to loan it out back to the banks or anywhere it wants, such as to the federal government, by buying its treasury bills or treasury bonds or treasury notes at a rate of interest that's greater than zero. And if they average, for instance, 4% or 5% return on these investments they make to the government or to the private banks for the money they borrowed at zero, they have a huge profit. One only has to think that there are trillions of dollars that are stored in the Federal Reserve. And so every second you're talking about millions of dollars of, or every minute at any rate, millions of dollars of interest earned on these deposits. So it's a very lucrative business to be able to gain a percentage on the money, on the 12-13% of all the money in America. So it's been quite a racket. Opposing the Federal Reserve has proven to be deadly by many people. Many people have found, even presidents like John F. Kennedy, and some people would say Abraham Lincoln, had their assassination plots fostered by those who loved the central bank, because Kennedy and Lincoln both tried to undermine the authority of the Federal Reserve. So anyway, the Federal Reserve is an interesting occurrence in American history, and it's something we need to be aware of. It's a tremendous problem in any economy. The article that Ebling writes is interesting for us because he says, look, in Panama, we just didn't have a central bank that we had to abolish. Things work pretty well down there. It's better for people to go back to a system where they don't have a Fed and the government isn't allowed to inflate and just borrow money like crazy and get these crazy budget deficits and large fiscal irresponsibility happening time and again. Well, we're going to go and try to take another break, folks, on the Tyranny Response Network. You've been listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We'll be back in a minute.
Listen to Liberty Minute with Dr. John Coben.
This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
Welcome back to the show. This is Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We're still experiencing some technical difficulties here, folks, and if you'll bear with me just a minute, we'll be right back. I'd like to welcome you back into Christian Worldview this morning. Still flying a little bit blind here. If folks are listening out there, I would appreciate a phone call or an email just to make sure that the broadcast is going through correctly. It's very difficult to run a studio solo as well as provide the content for the show. Just too much going on at once. So I'd appreciate phone call or email letting us know that we're being heard on the air and that all is going well. All the system looks like it's doing well, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it is. So I appreciate those who, if anybody can, just give us a phone call here, 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or send an email to questions@policyofliberty.net. Questions@policyofliberty.net. If you are listening live to the show, you should be hearing at any time here a break. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and see if I can't set us on to a break and see if you can hear this correctly. And if you can, please do let us know.
Listening to TRN.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben with Integrity Group. Why is it so difficult for Christians to be good stewards of their finances? We know that God works miracles in people's lives, but He has not chosen to provide manna from above to help us meet our needs as He did with the ancient Israelites. As Christians, we should be leading the way as good stewards. Since we do not spend money on vices like non-Christians do, we should be able to save more. We want to work hard and save our money so that we can have something to give to missions and to the needy. In addition, we want to regularly set aside a portion for retirement. Christians should not have to rely on taxpayer-funded government programs for retirement. No Christian wants to become a burden to their family or church during the ever-lengthening period of old age. At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. We are an independent financial planning firm. We specialize in finding creative custom solutions to meet your savings needs. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
Warning. Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955, weekday mornings from 7:30 to 9. You may also email your questions and comments 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of 6 homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
Welcome back to Christian Worldview. We're trying our best here to have a quality broadcast this morning. Not always the easiest thing to do when you're basically flying blind and flying solo here in the studio. We've had all sorts of technical issues this week because we've been upgrading equipment, hopefully making our long-term prospects on the Tyranny Response Network much better. And a lot of late nights for a lot of volunteers, and we appreciate all their efforts. Unfortunately, many of them are out of town today, and so we've ended up having a broadcast which has been riddled with all sorts of discrepancies here and there with things that are going on, at least in the station, things that should be done that aren't being done simply because the Tyranny Response Unit is not good at doing all things at the same time. You know, one Bible verse that I always like to think about, it's one of my favorite Bible verses for public policy as I think about the nature of the state and what goes on, is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 8. And he says, this is where the wise man says, probably Solomon says, "If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, Do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. I'll read that again. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Indeed, what we find in the scripture is that the Bible understands how government works, how the state works, how corrupt it can possibly be. And if you see perversion of justice or righteousness in the land, as we do in America today or in many countries in the world, or most probably every country in the world, don't marvel, God tells us. Why not? Because there is a system of bureaucracy, a system of power in which people are trying to pad their pockets or their power or their lifestyles in the way that they enjoy at the expense of other people or on the backs of other people. It's no surprise that these things occur when you have a hierarchy of power in place, and when we have states, we get evil. The scripture clearly states or teaches that government is not the friend of the church. And when I say government, I'm talking about the state here. I should use my terms correctly. The state, as it develops, becomes a plague to the church. It becomes something that harms the church, and that is detrimental to the life of the Christian faith. It also becomes detrimental to the life of all those who love liberty and freedom, and becomes a tool, an agent of Satan to produce misery and tyranny in the world. And so it is with the history of states. But the Bible itself, outside of the theocracy, in fact, if you just count up the references, as I did in my book, Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective, you'll find that just over 90% of all the references, and that's giving a pretty gracious reading to the passages, over 90% of the times the state is mentioned. It's mentioned as being evil, perverse, opposed to the ways of God, enslaving people, causing tyranny. 90% of the time outside of the theocracy. Theocracy, of course, was a special period of Old Testament history that I don't believe is ever going to be repeated again. Nevertheless, if you count the half of the kings in Judah, which were good, the other half were very evil, and all of the kings in the northern section of Israel were evil. Still, you have only 67% of the time that, or right around that number, that mentions of public policy and actions of the state or the state itself are qualified as evil in the scriptures. Only a third of the time, including the theocracy, are states considered to be doing something that's good. But again, because that's a non-repeatable event in history, I think the 90% figure is more accurate. This is what God teaches about government, what we can find about the nature of the state in the scriptures. It's an evil institution. It's an institution that frequently plagues people, that has on its purpose to exalt its promoters, to exalt its participants, and lord it over those constituents under it by ransacking their and pillaging them, enslaving them, putting them into military service for the benefit of government. I think this is the history in the Bible and been confirmed in the history of the world as well. Remember, when we look at R.J. Rummel, the great professor from the University of Hawaii, who's now basically retired, spent his entire life after World War II studying and counting the number of bodies that were murdered by governments of their own constituents. That is, he went around to different countries in the world looking up archives, doing statistical research, and found that in the 20th century alone, there were at least 170 million non-combatants killed by their own governments. And that's just the 20th century. And that number is probably very low. It could be as high as 700 million. More likely number, he says, is around 350 million non-combatants in the 20th century alone killed by their own governments. It's phenomenal, folks. Think about how much evil that is. How many folks that really is. You think about the entire population of a place like Los Angeles. Add it to the entire population of Chicago, and then the entire population of New York, and all the surrounding areas around these major cities. You might have, New York might have, if you stretched it, 20 million people. L.A. might have 14. Chicago might have pretty close to the same. Well, you know, that comes up to almost 50 million people. Well, 48 million people. That would only be a seventh. you wiped out every inhabitant in those areas, only a seventh, seven times more people than that were killed in the 20th century by malicious, malignant, cancerous, parasitic governments. And these are not the governments that are exceptions to the rule. In fact, they are the rule. The exception is the government that Thomas Jefferson envisioned, the government that allows liberty to be enjoyed by inhabitants, the government that resists collectivist ideas and resists those who would lord it over one another. Instead, it's a government that only provides for defense of the collective and helps to bring justice in the land. That kind of government is a rare thing in the history of the world. The vast majority have been tyrannical, nasty things that have destroyed people. Wow, what an impressive number, isn't it? 350 million people slaughtered by their own governments. Then let's add to that number all the babies that were aborted, which amount to something like 50 million per year that are murdered around the world. In this country alone, we have 1.5 million. Latest statistics I heard were something like 50 million children, unborn children, are murdered every year. That makes the number even more astounding. And then count the casualties of war, people who died in military service. Millions and millions from just World War II alone, not to mention World War I and all the other conflicts around the globe and during the 20th century. What an astounding artifact or piece of knowledge from history we get of how many people are killed through government or state action. It's sad but true. This is the nature of the state, and there's really not much more you can say about it other than that. At least in my view, it's an evil thing. It's something we have to be wary of completely all the time. And if we don't have a limited government, we end up with this tyrannical system. We're trying to oppose tyranny here at the Tyranny Response Unit, or the Tyranny Response Network. I am the Tyranny Response Unit. We're concerned about what goes on in this great nation because we actually had an opportunity to overthrow evil. We had to actually have an opportunity to oppose it in this country and won. One of the few examples in history where we're actually able to overthrow the evil state and establish liberty. Unfortunately, it only lasted until around the time that Abraham Lincoln brought it back to us. And all his cronies, his cabinet members, and then next president Grant, these kinds of people brought us more of the same back into the big government, big state, I should say, program once again. Sadly enough. Well, I want to refer back to deep questions for the radio show portion that you find on the policyofliberty.net website. If you scroll down to the bottom of policyofliberty.net, you'll find there a couple interesting links. One says, take the quiz. And this is an opportunity for you to find out what perspective of the four perspectives of Christian evangelical perspectives of public policy that you align yourself with. If you click that link, what will pop up in your Adobe Acrobat Reader is a 15 multiple-choice question self-guided quiz. Which helps you understand and think about public policy from a Christian perspective. And so if you pop up the link, you'll find the first five questions place you into one of two schools, the Competing Kingdom School or to the Integrated Authority School. The next 10 questions then define you even further into whether you hold to which of the four views that you hold, which are the divine right or the theonomic or Christian Reconstruction position, or if you're under the Competing Kingdom School, whether you hold to the pacifist or Anabaptist idea or the liberty of conscience position. Very helpful and instructive heuristic tool for you to help hone your thinking and consider these great issues of public policy as they're presented in the Scripture. So we do hope that you'll have an opportunity to click on that link. Also, if you take the link right above it, it's one that says Deep Questions for Dr. Coben's Radio Show. We'll pop up another Adobe Acrobat file with 18 questions, and these 18 questions are deep questions. They're not easy to read. Well, they're easy to read, but they're not easy to deal with kind of questions. They're tough, and this is a radio station, and this program in particular are dedicated to helping people think better. We want to have Christians, especially, instead of being gullible and voting for every George Bush that comes down the pipe and talks about things and with Christian lip service, we want Christians to be able to truly think about public policy issues, about warfare, about welfareism, about Social Security benefits, about student loans, about anything having to do with the state as it affects your life as a Christian in a better way. And so we indeed are hoping that you'll be able to read some of these questions and wrestle with them. These are not questions that you can lightly go over. You're going to have to wrestle with them a little bit, it's true. But we hope by wrestling with them you'll become a better thinker and better able to handle the questions that arise regarding public policy, or better able to interpret the activities and actions of the state within a biblical framework. So at any rate, your questions and comments are welcome to the show here at 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. You can also send your questions or comments by email to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. Well, I'd like to look at these 18 questions for Dr. Coben's radio show. And we've read a number of these on the show before, but I'd like us to go ahead and read a few others. For instance, question 4 says, Rome had no welfare state. Would the Apostle Paul have encouraged Christians to participate in welfare state programs or employment? This is an interesting question. I mean, we just take for granted that the welfare states always existed, when, as a matter of fact, before Otto von Bismarck in Germany, there was no concept of a welfare state instituted. He was towards the latter part of the 1800s. And so really for only the last 150 years does the world know anything about a welfare state, and it really has not been instituted in any wide capacity. And before, say, the last 75 years, not even that probably, 65 years, under Franklin Delano Roosevelt in this country and other presidents and kings, emperors, legislatures elsewhere around the world. So the fact of the matter is the Bible is a document that knew nothing about the welfare state. Now that shouldn't cause us any grief as Christians. The Bible also didn't know anything about machine guns or nuclear weapons or aircraft carriers or pesticides many other modern technological inventions or machinations of men. And the welfare state is one such a philosophy that just didn't exist then. Doesn't mean the principles of the scriptures don't apply anymore because everything's changed. In fact, they still do apply. Our goal as Christians and those who want to study the scriptures and be faithful to God's word need to find out how these principles can be applied today to the Christian worldview of today under the cultural and philosophical political conditions of our day. And in this particular instance, we are asking ourselves the question then, what about this welfare state? Some people have to say, and maybe I have some homeschoolers listening this morning, well, what is the welfare state? I don't understand that. Well, welfare state is any kind of government policy or program which does one of two things. First of all, it has to be concerned about changing your behavior. In other words, the philosophy is of the welfare state that there are people who don't know how to take care of themselves very well. They need a big brother like government to come and remind them to buckle up, remind them to wear a helmet when they're riding a motorcycle, help them to build their homes correctly, perhaps. Could be put into this, or zoned correctly, although that might also be under another category of public policy called the inefficient provision of goods and services that could be provided in the market. But anything that's designed to change your behavior, save gasoline, for instance, save water, or any other kind of energy, those things are behavior-changing parts of the welfare state. The other more insidious part, the more obvious part, is the redistribution of wealth. Any program designed to take money from one person who works, for instance, or who has amassed some wealth, and give it to somebody else who does not work or who lacks some basic skill is a welfare state program. For instance, unemployment benefits could well be a welfare state program. It really depends on how they're set up, but in large measure, unless they're set up privately with a true fund, they are simply confiscating from one person and giving it to another. The same thing would be true, and again, the unemployment issue is more thorny than others, but it'll depend on state to state and program to program. Others more obvious programs are things like Medicaid, where people who can't afford health care are given money that is looted and taken from other people so that they can have medical care. Public education is another means of actually redistributing wealth from one class, that is normally those who own real property, and give that the proceeds of the tax, or a good chunk of it, to fund a public education, and taking from those who have assets to those who do not, so that they can go to have a free education. Other welfare state programs include student loan programs or grant programs. Student loans, most student loans require a person to who gets the loan to not pay back any interest until after he graduates from school. Instead, during that time, the interest is paid by the taxpayer. He's looted, and he pays the interest on the loan. He also pays a rate of interest that is far below a market rate of interest. Students normally who have no job skills and no experience, who are very young, can't go out and get a signature loan easily at 6% or 8%. They might be able to get one at 16 or 18, but not at those low percentages, and that is a true economic cost that taxpayers also bear. Student grants, that money that comes in, other than lottery, which is completely different, financed by voluntary tax, all other student grants and so forth come from coercive confiscation and extortion policies of the state, taking tax money and then giving it to those who have no means, for instance, and they have a financial need. This is also a welfare state program. Social Security for retirees is a welfare state program. It was that way when FDR started the program. It still is. People who are working have their paychecks looted, and they pay for those who are currently retired. It is couched in mythical or hyperbolic language in some sense, where you think, well, I'm paying into the system, or I'm giving up a contribution for the progress of my own retirement fund, when in fact there is no fund in your name. There's nothing created for you. The Social Security requirement that you pay is simply another tax. You're taxed, you pay it in, and after you pay it in, it's immediately distributed to someone who's not working. It's like a Ponzi scheme, or as Walter Williams often calls it, a Ponzi scheme, a plan for intergenerational holdup. And that's precisely what it is. Well, at any rate, these are all examples of welfare state programs, and there are many other welfare state programs. Just name a few extras just quickly. Food stamps, Section 8 housing. These things are welfare state programs. The idea was, and under the Apostle Paul and Peter, when they write in the New Testament, they didn't have these programs. What would they have said about them, about these newfangled programs? It's a difficult question to answer, because obviously we're not the Apostle Paul or Peter, and we don't really know for sure what they would say. But we do know principally from other places in the Scriptures that Paul and Peter both condemn theft. They do not like the idea of a man not working for his own bread. Paul says specifically in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 that if a man doesn't work, neither should he eat. That's just the way it is. At any rate, we see in the Scriptures principles against theft. We also see the principles against idleness and against personal actions that would be extortionist. In Ephesians 4:28, Paul says, "Let him who stole steal no more." So we judge from those principles that that the welfare state itself, being a program of looting one person through the state system, the state apparatus, and benefiting yourself by filling out the application form and taking the cash that is looted for you, that's a violation of scriptural premise. So I conclude from that indeed, if there were a welfare state in Rome at the time Paul and Peter were writing, they would have opposed it. They would have told Christians to not participate in it. Now, I'm not saying they would have said, don't pay the taxes for it. That's a different issue, because it's not a sin, you see, to be stolen from. It would be good to hide out and make sure that you paid as little as possible. But if they steal your money, you haven't sinned. It's not a sin to be stolen from by the state. But it would be to participate and receive any benefits from others, thus implicitly steal from other people. This would be against the violation, I think, of the scriptural premise. So I am saying that by implication that Christians today who are involved with the welfare state sin when they take Social Security checks, when they take food stamps, when they take student aid, when they live in Section 8 housing, or use any of the other welfare state benefits that go along. I'm also saying that Christians should pay no part in the behavior modification schemes of the state, whether it be telling you how to drive correctly, how to be safer, how to conserve energy, encouraging you to behave in a way which is different than you do now, based on some worldly philosophy or some humanistic understanding of the world. These things also have to be rejected by Christians. We should not participate in them voluntarily. Once again, if you're forced to recycle your garbage and separate it, and if you don't, there will be some kind of fine laid against you. I don't think it's wrong to do so, but you should not voluntarily participate or condone these kinds of activities, and you certainly should not be employed by any agency of the state that is involved with welfare state behavior modification or redistributive policy. I don't know how it can be any clearer than that, but I do see that the Bible needs to be interpreted in terms of its principles, because simply the welfare state did not exist at the time the apostles Paul and Peter wrote. Most Christians don't realize that. They don't think about that. They just look at it as a tax, as a tax, as a tax. No matter what's called a tax, we just have to pay it. There should be no complaints. It could even participate in it. Sadly, they don't think about public policy from a biblical point of view as they should. It's a sad case, but that's the way the Christian church has gone, unfortunately. Well, we've read this question for the radio show number 4. There are other ones here as well that are of great interest. We've read in the past questions 1, 2, and 3, as well as number 5 about the Second Amendment. And number 6. We come then to question number 7, which I think, and for those of you who are listening, I should probably summarize these other 6 questions as I just mentioned them, and you may not be looking at them as I am. If you're at home, you have the luxury of flipping up your computer screen and going ahead and reviewing them online while I'm speaking. Otherwise, you may not have that luxury. At any rate, the first question has to do with self-defense, and it simply says, do Christians have a right of self-defense? Under what circumstance, against criminals or against governments, are there any instances in which Christians must not defend themselves? So it's a whole question about self-defense, and it goes on much longer than that. And then the second question, it says, may a government legalize crime or actions that God says are wicked? Is it allowed to do this sort of activity, which it frequently does? For instance, in the issue of abortion or euthanasia, were they allowed to kill human beings, the governments take it upon themselves to have the right to this sort of behavior. Is it right or wrong? The third question has to do with how the statements by Paul and Peter in Romans 13, Titus, and 1 Peter 2 have differed. How would they have differed if they had been written to modern-day Americans rather than under the Roman state? Interesting, similar question to what we just read about the welfare state. How would Paul and Peter phrase their questions or their comments had they had the American context of representative government instead of a king or a Caesar? The fifth question has to do with the Second Amendment, since it provides a built-in means of rebellion in the American system. Wasn't the case under the Roman Empire. They didn't have a Second Amendment. And the Second Amendment is there primarily for us to fight tyrannical government. So how does it differ now for us as Christians? Do we have the same obligations to the state? And if so, to what extent? And when do we get to play the rebellion card? Because it seems like Apostle Paul and Peter make it pretty clear that we have to submit, that rebellion is not a card that can be played by Christians. Is that true? Or is that now modified because of the kind of government we have? Remember, we don't have a king anymore either. And Paul or Peter says, honor the king. But we don't have a king, so who do we honor? The Constitution, George Bush, the Congress? These are interesting questions, and we've addressed those in previous shows. And in question 6, in fact, question 6 is a continuation of that very theme. Well, question 7, which we'll read also now, we have about 7 minutes left in the show, we'll try to end up with this. It says, do Christians have rights? Is it proper for them to assert their rights as Americans? If so, to what extent? Was Stonewall Jackson, a strong and devout Christian, wrong in asserting his rights to self-defense, property, and liberty? If so, why? We have covered this at one point earlier in the show. We want to do so here again today. Christians in the Scriptures, you have no rights against one another, or even rights in a sense against unbelievers, because we are called upon to lay down our lives for one another. We're called upon to suffer. Even to being defrauded by other people. It doesn't mean we can't defend ourselves against a lunatic or a brother gone mad, but it simply means that we are to have a deferential attitude in our lives towards the way we treat other people and how we think. There's no greater love than this, that a man lays down his life for his friends, Jesus says, And our attitude should be the one that he had in Philippians 2, where he emptied himself of even his Godhead and took on the form of a servant. In fact, that passage is so important, I might flip over to there, Philippians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul writing to this church that was doing very well. He says, "Therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, verse 1, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking on the form of a bondservant, and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of a cross." So the attitude of Christ was to empty himself of all his divine glory, and come here, take on the humble clothing of flesh and of a man, and live. Of course, he lived a perfect life, but he also lived a life of sacrifice and service to others. So Christians towards one another, and even towards those who are unbelievers, are not to exercise rights as if they have a right to have their way over another person's way. Now, this doesn't exclude Christians from dealing with criminals, even criminals who profess to be Christians. It also doesn't preclude Christians from going to court against unbelievers. It does preclude them from going to court against other believers. They can't do that, according to 1 Corinthians 6. But if they're attacked or assailed by a government agency or by another person for whatever reason, they can defend themselves in court, and they can exercise political rights there. But in general, they have no rights in their, as a mindset. They're here to serve, to love, to sacrifice. That's a hard calling to be a Christian, but that indeed is what God calls us to do. But then again, there's the whole issue of political rights. Christians are also citizens as well as church members and going about their private lives. Is it proper for them, as question 7 says, to assert their rights as Americans? Well, the Apostle Paul asserted his rights as a Roman citizen. Remember, he appealed to Caesar. He made it very clear when he was about to be abused by people, take care of what you're doing because I'm a Roman. And when the Roman centurion hears that he's actually a Roman citizen, he fears because there is a certain level of respect that had to be granted to a Roman citizen. So Paul exercised his rights as a Roman citizen, and therefore I think we can safely say that it's okay for us to exercise rights as Americans. The rights that we have are contained in the Bill of Rights. They're also embodied in things like the Declaration of Independence, where we believe that we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness or property. So we can assert these rights, as the Apostle Paul did, as American citizens, and therefore we can hold out rights that we have against the state. Liberty is always defined as freedom from the state. There is no other way we can conceive of what liberty would mean other than perhaps in a personal sense of not being enslaved to some other man, but in a conceptual, philosophical, or I guess a larger a political sense, we always are talking about political freedom, meaning freedom from government, freedom from the state and its intrusions into our lives. So we can hold up our rights against those intrusions as Christians, and as God has provided for us, especially in this country, so many rights compared to other people, we should be good stewards of these things and exercise them with great caution and diligence. To what extent is the next part of this question? If Christians can assert their rights as Americans, if so, to what extent? Well, I think the fullest extent possible. I think the Apostle Paul pulled out all the stops, and we can as well. If we have a right as an American citizen to oppose tyranny, to oppose the wickedness of our state, or to maintain a standard of living and a quality of lifestyle that is congruent with God's word by asserting rights, then we should do so. If we have the right to homeschool, we should homeschool, or at least use a Christian school. There's no excuse for us to use a public school. Money is certainly not a good reason. There are many ways a person can, for instance, homeschool very inexpensively. Even while he's working full-time, it's still possible to do it. It's more difficult. Single parents have a difficult time with it, but it still is a possibility. Was Stonewall Jackson wrong or it says here, was Stonewall Jackson a strong and devout Christian? No doubt about that. Wrong in asserting his rights to self-defense, property, and liberty? If so, why? When the North invaded the South, was it wrong for Stonewall Jackson to resist? He was a believer, and he believed that that when those were invading his country, like they were, and going to hurt his property, harm his family, he had a right of defense. Well, some Christians don't agree with this, but I think he does have a right of self-defense. When Paul tells a man to be providing for his family, and if he doesn't, he's worse than an infidel, I think that's not just money. I think he's talking about taking your gun out if necessary and shooting the people that come to prey on your family. It may mean that you die in the process, or maybe even they all die in the process, but you have an obligation at least to try to defend your family against these predators that would come around. And so I think Stonewall Jackson did what was right in opposing the aggression from the North. So anyway, this is an interesting question, number 7 on the deep questions. We hope you have an opportunity to read these deep questions by going to policyofliberty.net and clicking on the link to deep questions for Dr. Coben's radio show, and have an opportunity to read through them, think about them, and then send us an email to questions@policyofliberty.net. Let us know what you think about them. Let us know what the results are of the quiz you take, which is also located at that link at the bottom of policyofliberty.net. Well, we've come to the end of the program today. It's been a difficult day for programming for us, and we're really thankful that you all have borne with us in our technical quandary this morning, and we look forward to seeing you once again on Monday morning for another edition of Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben on the Tyranny Response Network. Until then, thanks again, and God bless you.
View with Dr. John Coben on TRN. Join us again tomorrow morning right here at 97.7 FM on the Tyranny Response Network for Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben with Integrity Group. Why is it so difficult for Christians to be good stewards of their finances? We know that God works miracles in people's lives, but He has not chosen to provide manna from above to help us meet our needs as He did with the ancient Israelites. As Christians, we should be leading the way as good stewards. Since we do not spend money on vices like non-Christians do, we should be able to save more. We want to work hard and save our money so that we can have something to give to missions and to the needy. In addition, we want to regularly set aside a portion for retirement. Christians should not have to rely on taxpayer-funded government programs for retirement. No Christian wants to become a burden to their family or church during the ever-lengthening period of old age. At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. We are an independent financial planning firm. We specialize in finding creative custom solutions to meet your savings needs. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.